Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Pearlman. My guest is writer, screenwriter, and professor Austin Bunn. Bunn is a graduate of Yale University and the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He is currently an assistant professor in the Department of Performing and Media Arts at Cornell University. His electrifying and beautifully written debut collection of stories called The Brink was published by Harper Perennial in 2015. He is a co-author of the screenplay Kill Your Darlings, which debuted at the Sundance Film Festival. Bunn's writing has also appeared in the New York Times Magazine and the Atlantic Monthly. And welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Tish.
Now, I want to know, did you start getting interested in writing as a child? Were you coming from a writing family?
My mom is an academic, and she taught Spanish language. And in some ways, you see that throughout the book, an interest in language. I would credit my mom for that. I think I started writing short fiction when I was in about 6th or 7th grade. I would write out the stories on graph paper, and then I would actually hand them to friends along with a tape that I had made of the music I wanted people to listen to while they read the story,
In
some ways is a precursor for getting involved in film. It's so related to story and music and sound at the same time.
But you had that sensibility as a kid.
You know, I was always interested in the monologue form and radio plays. My mom gave me a copy of this Alfred Hitchcock record when I was a kid, so I would fall asleep listening to Alfred Hitchcock ghost stories, and you can still find some of them on Spotify. I was just listening to them the other night, and I feel like that form is still with us with podcasts and the way the radio has reemerged as a form for people to listen to stories.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the voice is never going to go away. We love hearing stories from each other. Now, let us talk about your debut story collection, The Brink. It seems to be part science fiction, kind of Roald Dahl-ish, you know, all those great short story authors. Tell me about it. I mean, the concept is kind of dark and kind of frightening, some of it.
Yeah. Well, I suppose I had the great, occasion of writing a bunch of these stories and then realizing after the fact that they were connected thematically. I think some writers sit down, especially with short story collections, with an intention in mind. I'm going to tell the stories of a bunch of people in an apartment building or Visit from the Goon Squad, which is just an amazing short story collection by Jennifer Egan. That's the story of a band over time and who they become. Well, with this, I was just trying to tap into the things that really made me want to sit and write. And those tended to be experiences that were transformational or extreme. And I grew up under the shadow of nuclear holocaust,
you
like a lot of
us. You mentioned that in an interview, and then that really affected you. There's a story in The Brink, the very first one, How to Win an Unwinnable War. It brought back, you know, kind of bad memories to me. I grew up in the late 50s and early 60s. And we were hiding under tables.
But the
same with your generation.
So I was late 80s. We were still hiding under tables, although The Day After had come out, and that sort of made the point that hiding under the table didn't make any difference. So I think as a kid, I was a little bit maybe a nervous kid, a neurotic kid. I was afraid of the end of the world. But I also saw opportunities there and the way that people would change. And so that first story comes from that early anxiety. And I tried to link it to another autobiographical element, my parents' divorce. They had been divorced for a few years before I actually took this class. I should say the story is about a young man who takes a class in nuclear war gaming. And so I linked the idea of the Cold War to this parents' separation and their divorce. And I tried to have some fun connecting those two ideas, like the macro geopolitical to something really intimate and personal.
That was great. I mean, I was captured just from that first story. I thought it was really fascinating.
Thank you.
Now, I also found The Ledge fascinating, too. Haunting, really. I mean, and that one's about a 15th century ship, and they find the end of the earth.
Oh, yeah,
and
great.
And it's a very interesting story. Tell me where that came from.
So that story definitely owes a lot to my mom, whose field of research as an academic was Don Quixote and early Spanish Golden Age literature, they call it, in theater. So I grew up with Don Quixote statuary all around our house, and she would give lectures about Don Quixote. So I was drawn to that moment of fabulation and fantasy that occurs kind of right at the edge of modernity. And I had the idea, I often work from visual images, and that story began with the idea of conquistadors just encountering the edge of the ocean and what would happen next, and just letting the story unspool what would happen. And a friend of mine has joked that it's one of these stories that has four genres operating at the same time. It's a seafaring, queer, ghost story, all at the same time, all mashed up into something that feels almost like a fable.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm very proud of that story. Some people find the language really unusual and maybe dense because it's interested in period languages and period understanding of things. Like, as you noticed, I mentioned it's a queer short story, but the word gay never appears anywhere in the story.
No. And that language steeps you in the atmosphere. I loved it. And that's one of my favorite stories in the collection.
Great. Thank you so much. That was one that I didn't know where to put. You know, it's an unusual story because it's set in the past, so far in the past. And so I decided to put it in the middle of the book, knowing at that point people would have hopefully understood a little bit of the ambition of the book and my intention and wouldn't be put off by something that just seemed so different from our lives
now.
Yeah,
I thought it was fascinating. I'm so glad you had it in there. It does seem like an outlier in some ways, but it goes with the theme of the brink.
There we go, for a while I had the idea the book cover was going to be an image of a cubic end of the ocean, just a square edge. But the publisher came up with something better. So anyway, that story inspired that cover.
That was a great story. Now, where else do your ideas come from? To tell us. Are you a news freak? Are you somebody who sits around parks and waits for images to come into your head? How do you do that?
I would say, I teach these days creative writing, specifically playwriting and screenwriting. And students ask that a lot and almost want to cultivate that skill sometimes. For me, I used to be a journalist. I've always been interested in the news and true stories. A few of the stories from The Brink are based on true stories or news stories.
I was wondering, yeah.
The one that's called The Worst You Can Imagine Is Where This Starts is a pretty dark short story.
It is
that's a true story.
Dark. Mm-hmm.
I was living in Michigan at the time and read a little news story about a father who discovered a dead baby in his basement in a plastic bag. And in turning it over to the police, they eventually identified his own daughter as the murderer. And she was jailed for infanticide, even as a young woman.
Yeah. So not what happens in this story,
well,
though, folks.
You're right. I decided to take a different direction and give him something to do. I put myself in that position. What would happen? So I've always been drawn to news. I keep a journal of different ideas. I work very visually, so I find myself drawn to images. And it's maybe one of the reasons why I've ended up doing more screenwriting, because for whatever reason, visual images have been really an inspiration for me.
Yeah, well, it stands out in these stories. The visual imagery is just amazing to me.
Thank you. That's great.
I was really impressed. Now, the story Curious Father, a father questioning his sexuality, might that have something to do with something going on in your world?
Well, so I should say that story is also based on the experiences of an ex-boyfriend of mine who was a man coming out of a marriage and had decided to go upstate, actually to a place called Dawn Manor, as it's called in the short story, which is on the backside of the Catskills. And it's really a spiritual retreat for men coming out in middle age or considering their sexuality or just trying to do some inner work. And at the time he told me the story, I mean, he mentioned just how unusual the people who were there were because they were all in places of transition.
Yeah.
And I have also worked in theater, and I was really drawn to what would happen in this environment with a bunch of men whose idea of masculinity was being reconsidered. And what would transpire if something violent happened? And where would they find strength and how would they react? So I wrote a play, actually. This Curious Father was originally a full-length play.
Wow.
And then I moved it back into fiction. Because I thought there was more to do. And as you can imagine, in a play, it's so much about the scene and monologue. And I wanted to tell that inner experience that Henry, the main character, has.
Yeah.
What happened? What transpires over that weekend?
That seemed very real to me. I mean, I lived for many years in San Francisco, and I met a lot of men who were questioning their sexuality. I mean, all over the place.
Yeah.
So that seemed very realistic to me.
Well, I'm glad you think so. I think that question of sexual identity, sexual development, for especially when you're no longer a teenager, can become a very catalytic and in some ways really challenging experience. Certainly any gay person knows people who have not come out as a teenager, say, and are in their 30s or their 40s and are trying to figure out what life will look like after a marriage or heading into a marriage. And I feel like that's a really exciting place to write, because characters who are discovering things about themselves or making irrevocable choices, those are great moments to write into.
Yeah, yeah. So that story rang true for the people that I met all over San Francisco, you know. A lot of your characters are uncomfortable and literally on the brink in many ways. So what leads you to that particular part of life, radical changes on the brink of?
Someone else, a lot of people have asked me about this, actually. And
do you think it is because you're a gay man?
I don't think so much. I think what I would say is I think the writing we produce tends to come from the writing we're also eating or reading.
Uh-huh.
And I have always been interested in writers like Sam Lipsight or Chuck Palahniuk is someone whose early work I really responded to. And he comes out of this tradition called burnt tongue. And that's really a term that his teacher, so Tom Spanbauer, was the mentor for Chuck Palahniuk. And he still writes. He lives in Portland. And he has this approach that the stories we tell are about experiences that have just happened and you need to tell them. So you've come from a car crash. You wander into a bar. What is the story you tell? And that's burnt tongue. And I found myself really drawn to that idea as a playwright and as a storyteller, just wanting stories to feel really urgent. I know there are many writers who are great at producing fairly docile or bucolic kind of writing or just deeply internal writing. Alice Munro might be a master of that.
Oh, yeah.
And that was just never something that I was going to produce. I think I'm interested in genre, and having grown up listening to Alfred Hitchcock and this record called The Sounds of Death my mom gave me because she knew I was interested in dark things. And this record actually features the sounds of people getting burned alive and drowning. And, I mean, it's a really terrifying record to listen to as a grown-up. But my mom realized that I was listening to it in a different way. It sounded like sound effect. It was exciting. And so I think I have to admit that there's some part of me that's still that little boy who likes things to feel intense and that they grab you by the lapels and propel you to read them.
So in some ways, if that's the way your character was as a kid, you had to go into writing or it would have been a destructive outcome.
I could have been a very different kid. I've worked on a monologue that taps into some of this because I think these days kids like that get thought of as, for example, just baby sociopaths or a little Dylan Klebold or something.
Yeah.
And there was a period in the 80s where I guess it was just considered these records were produced for kids and it was just considered something fun and something for them to listen to, a playful thing. I remember my mom letting me go see horror movies as a 8-9-year-old on the college campus and going to see them at the campus movie theater. And looking back, you know, some of those were pretty extreme and they were hard for me to take, but that's what I was interested in. And so you're seeing the vestiges of that, I think, in my prose.
Yeah, that's really interesting that your mother was able to, you know, help you feed that.
I think
part
she
of
saw
your
it as an saw it as an aesthetic thing. As an academic, she could understand that I was trying to appreciate it, not just to get scared, but that there was a story being told. There's something really powerful about that.
Yeah.
Ghost stories specifically.
Yeah, I was interested in ghost stories and horror stories and true crime stories when I was a kid.
Well, look at The Hunger Games or even, you know, the Divergent series or Goosebumps. I think kids actually are very curious about this material and I mean, you could even look at Hans Christian Andersen. The original stories are really quite dark.
Yeah, they are.
And
gruesome.
We like to think that we need to feed kids positive stories all the time or stories about success or social integration. But there's another narrative there that's worth thinking about, which have to do with darker stories of decay and disintegration.
And it's part of our character. It's part of our primitive brain in some ways. Mm. And that's what I would think. Now, let's talk about the screenplay you wrote for a film called Kill Your Darlings.
Yeah.
Really interesting film. It's about a killing and the beat writers.
Yeah.
So tell us about it. How did you get hooked up into making a film like this?
So like a lot of beat writing fans, I discovered the Beats in college. And I can remember going to the campus bookstore and reading Allen Ginsberg poetry. And not even really the good Allen Ginsberg poetry. He produced a lot of junky poetry.
Yeah, he did.
But when you were an 18, 19-year-old, to me, it was completely radical. I couldn't believe his honesty and just his forthrightness. And I got really excited by Ginsberg poetry, which led me to Kerouac. And for whatever reason, each of these writers is a gateway drug. Some people come in through Kerouac. Some people come in through Burroughs. For me, it was Ginsberg, probably as a closeted gay kid in college. So I had always been really interested in them. And then you read a little beat, you read a lot of beats, typically. And that led me to the biographies. And there's anecdote in almost all of the biographies about this murder that they had gotten wrapped up in of a man named David Kammerer, who was an older gay man in his 30s. That had befriended this fourth beat, this kind of unknown beat named Lucien Carr.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing is this anecdote about this murder trial that they were involved in was almost the same in every biography. It's as though everyone just didn't even want to touch the topic as biographers. And so I began doing more research and feeling like, wow, this was really an untold story. I was so surprised that somebody like Ginsberg, who I really admired for his honesty, had gotten involved in helping effectively defend someone who had killed a gay man just out of a homophobic panic.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it turned out Lucien Carr was someone Ginsberg really loved and really cared for. And so it made sense emotionally, but for me as a reader, I just thought there's a lot of material here. So I had decided to turn it into a nonfiction book, and my college roommate became a film director, and that's how the film got made.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Austin Bunn. He's a writer and a screenwriter, and we're talking about his debut collection of short stories and some of his films and screenplays. Let's talk a little bit more about Kill Your Darlings. I mean, did you end up having to do a whole bunch of research? And obviously, some of the people connected to these people are still alive.
Yeah.
Did you have to worry about that?
Well, that's you've raised an interesting point. With films that are based on a true story like this one, with major literary figures, it can be really challenging to make a film without the permission of the estates. And in fact, the estates had decided that no one was really supposed to talk about this murder, mm-hmm. that Lucien Carr, who was in fact the last surviving person who had been involved, passed away in 2006. Mm. And that changed a lot of things. So we had had this idea in about 2004, but we knew we really weren't going to be able to make a film until Lucien had passed away. Lucien Carr also had prohibited the Beats from really writing about it. He had asked them personally, please don't publish on this. I don't want you to write about it. I just want to forget about it. So when he died, the Kerouac Estates and the Burroughs Estates knew that they had this manuscript called And the Hippos Were Boiled in Their Tanks, which was this co-written novel that Burroughs and Kerouac had produced as young men about the murder. And that finally got published in 2009, I think. But we had already written a screenplay based on the story, and so that had already been registered. So we had just touched on a similar topic. And at that point, 2008, we had a final draft of the screenplay. It had a whole cast. Different actors that were associated with the film, all of whom were really exciting to have in place, but the financing wasn't able to come through. So it took another 4 years, 5 years, and I really should credit the film's director, John Krakitis, for his perseverance because, you know, just as the screenwriter, you're really not involved in those conversations.
Yeah.
But John wouldn't give up on the idea, and he helped bring in the financing and convince other actors. And so we ended up with this terrific cast, Daniel Radcliffe and Michael C. Hall from Dexter, and a young actor, Dane DeHaan, who's just terrific. And so the film was shot in 2012, and in 2013 it came out.
God, I thought it was a fascinating film.
Thank you. I really did.
I saw it on DVD, of course.
Oh, great.
It wasn't released everywhere, you know. Were there any repercussions from that story finally surfacing? I mean, did anybody...
Well, the estates eventually approached the production company about getting some kind of money to effectively permit it to be released, even though no one is still alive who was involved in the murder trial, the estates still have power over the use of their name and things like that. So I think there was some effort to negotiate with them. We really had nothing to do with it. The production company really was responsible for that. The repercussions have only been positive, really. For a lot of people, this is a story that is that's untold, and for Beat historians, it was kind of exciting. I feel we got a lot of kudos for the fact that the script is very accurate, period accurate, to who these men were, the dialogue, the kinds of details that really told the story. And I would say one poignancy about it was I know how important and transformational the Beats were, but we would go to screenings, and young students would say, who are these guys? I didn't even know Allen Ginsberg wrote poetry, or
really?
I didn't know he was gay. And you think, like, wow, that literature is, you know, it's at this point approaching 100 years old. And its relevance is, it still needs to sort of be re-earned, I think.
That's really amazing that people wouldn't be teaching Ginsberg, at least.
I think it's just that the canon's pretty broadening in a great way. And so I don't know that they're necessarily at the top of the list. It's a little bit like Bukowski. And so students have their private canon, and they find their way there, but they're not necessarily taught in class.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the short documentaries you've done, Lavender Hill In the Hollow.
Yeah.
What were those about?
So they're both Ithaca-based in certain ways, and I moved here in 2012, and the chair of my department said to me, listen, when you get here, you really should check out Lavender Hill. You really enjoy that neighborhood. And I thought that meant there was this Castro of Ithaca and that there was this mountainside community I was going to get to check out. And it turned out Lavender Hill is a small former commune outside, I want to say West Danby, but I always get confused. And it was a phenomenal little social experiment of gay men and lesbians living together. It lasted about 10 years. And eventually, my partner and I, Bob, made the documentary about the kind of ascent, the life and times of this commune. And it's been a wonderful experience. We met a bunch of local Ithacans, some of whom I'm sure you know, who were involved in the Moosewood, who work at the Moosewood, who have lives that have continued here. And the other documentary, In the Hollow, tells the story of Claudia Brenner and her girlfriend, Rebecca, and this hike that they took on the Appalachian Trail in 1988 and this notorious shooting that took place on the trail. Only one of them lived. Claudia now lives here in Ithaca. And it was the story of bringing Claudia back to the Appalachian Trail to hike back to the place where Rebecca was shot.
Wow, this is way before In the Wild became hiking and obviously not murders. But
well, that's true. You know, Claudia is someone who has for a while became an advocate for bias crime legislation, but she has reached a point where this happened 20-some years ago. You know, she lives a life here as an architect and has other things going on. It had been many years, I think, since she had really turned her eye to this point in her life, and she had never collaborated with anyone on a film. And for whatever reason, she had seen Lavender Hill and wanted to collaborate. So she opened herself to that process in a great way. And I feel really privileged. The film is a powerful story, I think, of these. We follow the two young women hiking, two actresses, telling the story of what the hike was like and the story of the older woman who returns to a little bit walk through her own footsteps in the past. And we shot it on the Appalachian Trail. Wow. Where everything happened.
Wow, that's – are these available on DVD?
So Lavender Hill is publicly available on the internet if you search for it. Lavender Hill short film. In the Hollow is still playing at film festivals, so we're not able to permit it to be screened publicly online. But if anyone's interested, they can email me and we can send people a link.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. And these were shown at Frameline in San Francisco. I, of course, know Frameline, very famous gay film festival. And also the Outfest in L.A. These films are getting some really good PR.
We've been really excited to share it with audiences. I think especially within the Hollow, it's a story not a lot of people know, and it's a little bit like a Matt Shepard narrative, except Claudia lived. And so it's a really powerful story. It's a short film. It's only 14 minutes long, but we've been really honored to share it with different audiences. It's right now, I think it's playing in Amsterdam in a month. It's toured internationally. It's won a bunch of best short film prizes. I think that's a testament really to Claudia and her strength and her survival. So we did a screening here in town last summer when we first finished it. But people have been clamoring to see it again, so we might do another screening at some point.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating. Now, you seem to write in every genre that you can think of. You wrote a monologue called The Basement Story, and it won a Missouri Review Audio Essay Prize. Tell us what that was about. Monologues,
well, we've touched
Austin.
Monologues. Well, I mean, I guess I'm doing one right now in some ways. I love the radio. I listen to podcasts all the time. And I'm a big fan of The Moth and This American Life. And I knew I wanted to write one just as an effort to do some sound recording and trap a personal story that I could travel with and do it for different audiences. Basement Story began as an exercise in trying to imagine a stage piece that would just have minimal props and what could I really build? What story could I tell? And so I scrolled back and thought about those ghost stories that I listened to as a kid. And I told a personal story of my mother sold our childhood home a few years ago, and I had to go back and help her clean out the basement. And I imagined what would transpire in those discoveries in the basement, the old things that you've forgotten. And one of the items that I discover in the monologue, true to life, is this record, The Sounds of Death. And so you get a chance to hear the record and understand my curiosity about it. Although I do some fictionalization, and it's really a performance essay more than an essay per se, in that I meld some details of my biography with my twin brother's biography.
Wow.
And so it's had a chance to play it at Third Coast and on WBEZ and Michigan Public Radio. I mean, it's been really fun. I know my brother who lives in Chicago, sometimes friends will reach out to him and say, I just heard this story on the radio about Colin Bunn, and like, are you okay? You know, because the story gets pretty dark. I mean, if you think, I mean, the brink is certainly touches on similar issues, but Basement Story explores, I would say, adolescent feelings of sociopathy and darkness. So anyway, it's an intense piece.
So do you have acting experience too? Do you use different voices when you do the monologue?
You know, I grew up doing acting all the time, and I don't know that I'm very good at it. I just prefer to tell stories in my own voice. So I've done some acting, and I've had some friends. I went to graduate school and got an MFA in fiction and playwriting. Mm-hmm. And some of the people that I met in graduate school, Sean Lewis, Jennifer Fawcett, are solo performers and have done great touring shows. So they taught me quite a bit about how to do that, how to command a stage and how to block yourself and design something. So I've learned a good bit. I wouldn't say I'm a master, but I do enjoy it. And I certainly love watching solo performance.
Well, you have a great voice for that. I can tell.
Oh, thank you.
You're able to express yourself quite well, I must say. Now, let's talk about the Iowa Writers Workshop.
Sure.
I know so many writers who've gone there, graduated from there, whatever you want to call it. What happens there? What makes it so special? And did it really help you as a writer?
It's something I've thought about a lot and talk about with friends who are graduates. And there are a number of MFA programs now that I think are excellent. So I don't want to talk about Iowa as though it's the only program. Mm-hmm. It is the oldest program. And I think that's why people know it so well. It's produced so many writers because it's been around much longer than other programs.
Yeah.
It's also quite large. I think it accepts 25 fiction writers and 25 poets a year. So it's an MFA in creative writing, and you do workshops and you take seminars. I studied with Marilyn Robinson. Some of your listeners may know the author of Gilead and
Absolutely.
Housekeeping and Home.
And her famous interviews with Barack Obama recently.
Yes. And she was a very powerful teacher for me. I would admit that I don't think she really enjoyed my writing, and I would have loved for her to have appreciated what I was doing. But what she came to teach me was that writing, the best kind of writing, at least for her, had to do with interiority and capturing the inner experience of life, because that's what only literature could do. And once you start to look at books that way, you really discover that there's a certain beauty to literature that it itself can do. I mean, film and television will do action and adventure and certain kinds of scenes, dialogue-laden stories that books don't really need to do anymore. And her own work, as you can imagine, is really suffused with that inner light and the stories of a character, life through their eyes. So the Writer's Workshop was a great experience. It was challenging. You have to produce a lot of work. And I went as a 29-year-old, so I was a little bit older than the other students there. And I spent many days writing and produced some of the stories in The Brink begin there. I would say maybe two or three. So it was a really powerful experience. I think there are lots of – Cornell has an MFA program as well, which I think also has its strengths.
Yeah.
So it's worth thinking about.
But it's probably a good way to hone what you know you want to do and perhaps find the discipline to do it. I mean, that's a big problem for some beginning writers.
Well, I think what I would say is it has to do with finding a peer group. I think a lot of people write on their own and are desperate to have readers and people to help develop their work. And a place like Iowa, you have a whole social group that is very invested in each other. So I feel – I mean, I can think like Eden Lapucky is a writer who came through town last year. She wrote California. She was a classmate of mine, and that book was a bestseller. And she's given me feedback on work, and I've given her feedback on work. So I feel there's a big community of writers out there, and an MFA helps introduce you to them.
Yeah. And you know, I hear people say that they don't like to read fiction. They don't want to be in fake lives. But I still find fiction, literary fiction, one of the best ways to portray the inner life.
Yeah.
Better than TV, better, you know?
Yeah, you're speaking my language.
It's really fascinating that genre is still going so strong. And it's because of that, don't you?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we live in a time when there's so much stimulus of external life and information visually told that a novel that takes you inside characters is a deep pleasure and a unique one, although it does require a certain kind of sanctuary and protectiveness, because it's all too easy to be distracted by, wow, I mean, solitaire on my phone, for example. I mean, I want that daily challenge every day. But I'm a big fan of books, and I love going to Buffalo Street Books and picking up whatever's new. And
Yeah. Now, we are almost out of time. What are you working on now? Anything you can tell us about?
Sure. So the thing that I'm really excited about right now is I've been raising the money to make another short film, this time a part of a feature film that is set inside the Redwood Canopy. So it's a feature film that probably 70% of the story happens 200 to 300 feet above the ground inside a very old tree.
Wow.
And it's based on a play that I wrote that has to do with the legacy of environmental activism. I wrote a play about the tree-sit world, so young people who decide to move up into trees to protest unsustainable logging. So this is a story that transpires a little bit like Castaway or maybe All Is Lost, on a 6-foot by 8-foot platform, 250 feet in the air.
Wow, we can't wait for that to happen. Contact information so people can get in touch
with
you.
Sure. Well, I think my website would be the easiest. So my website is austinbunn.com, and they can reach me at Cornell. And, of course, if you Google the book, The Brink, you can find an Amazon page, and that'll link you to my page, and people can contact me that way.
That's great. Well, Austin Bunn, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure. Again, his collection of short stories is called The Brink. Go out and get it. It is a unique experience. Thank you, Austin.
Thank you, Tish, for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.